Okay, meeting comes to order of the Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee today on February 22nd. We do have a quorum and approval of the minutes. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are fine-looking minutes, and I would like to move their approval.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hoppe. He moves approval of the minutes of the February 17th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and minutes are approved. Members, today we have two bills that we'll be hearing, and we'll do an overview of the constitutional amendment process. But before we bring the first bill up, I'd just like to make notes on your agenda as item number three. Officially yesterday we heard from the Speaker of the House about the appointment of the Pension Commission members, and as you know, pension issues come through our committee. And you see the list there of the members of the Pension Commission, and I'm happy to say that we have one member from our committee. In the past, there's been zero, so Representative Lynn Wardlow will be our connection to that Pension Commission. The other members appointed are Representative Steve Smith, Representative Dennis Osment, Representative Mary Murphy, and Representative Paul Thiessen. So if you have pension questions or issues, please direct them through Representative Lynn Wardlow, who also serves as the lead on our discussion group related to that. Okay, so let's go ahead and start our first bill here. It's House File 913. Representative Beard, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 913, recommend it for passage, and where would you like it sent next?
We're wondering about fiscal note and if it needs to go to state government finance.
Oh, no, that's Representative Seifert's committee.
Kiss him down.
You feel lucky today?
No.
Okay,
I don't think
we're going to go right to the floor.
Great. Thank you very much, members.
Okay, Representative Beard moves House File 913 be recommended to pass and go right to the General Register. And I see there's a couple of amendments. Are those yours? Did you want to move those?
They are. Madam Chair, I'd like to move. Let's move the A1 amendment first to get the bill into the shape we need for discussion.
Thank you. Let's take care of that. Representative Beard moves the H.O. 913 A1 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Did you want to put the A2 on as well?
Madam Chair, that's going to be a more exciting one to talk about. I would like to move it.
Okay, and you want to describe the whole bill as amended after that?
If I may, yes.
Okay, let's do that. Representative Beard moves the H.O. 913 A2 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor of the A2 amendment to put the bill in the order the author would appreciate? Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails and amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Beard, your bill is now in the shape as amended. Please present your bill with those changes.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. House File 913 is the, I suppose we could call it the do or housekeeping bill for this year. As those of us who have been here before know, usually the agency bills that have deletions and cleanup language and so on are usually mind-numbingly boring. There were two, I thought, absolutely fascinating sections in this bill that I was looking forward to engaging in the debate with you this morning. However, my A1 amendment took one of them away because staff fixed the problem without us getting our fingers into it. I apologize for that. Actually, the A1 amendment reinstates language that related to change in insurance benefits for legislators. If you'd like me to just describe what we did, it's apparently under the Constitution, we as elected policymakers are not allowed to vote ourselves benefits that we can actually enjoy without having gone through the privilege of a re-election cycle. You understand that? In other words, we can't vote ourselves pay raises. We can vote the next legislature pay raises. And under the requirements of this section that we just reinstated, representatives of the Department of Employee Relations expressed a concern that if they changed health plans in the middle of an election cycle, that somehow was perceived by the system as a benefit to us, and so we could not move to the new health plan without the benefit of an election cycle intervening. We're up every 2 years. It was more of a problem in the Senate where they're up every 4 years. However, staff worked out language that they assure us allows the Department of Administration to move us to a new health plan immediately if the benefit does not exceed the one that we currently enjoy. Is that clear to everyone? So I was looking forward to the discussion, but it turns out we don't need to have it. The A2 amendment, however, is a little bit different. Before we go there, though, what I'm going to do, Madam Chair, is turn this over to Ms. Liz Holding, who's the manager of State Employee Relations for the Department of Employee Relations, to talk about the other four sections of the bill, and then we'll get into the meat and potatoes of the A2 amendment.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Holden. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Liz Holding, the Director of the Employee Insurance Division at Dewar. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to talk a little bit about the State Employee Group Insurance Program bill. It proposes several provisions which will make the administration of employee health insurance more effective and efficient. As you know, the Department of Employee Relations is responsible for providing benefits to the executive, judicial, and legislative branches of government, as well as quasi-state agencies such as the Minnesota Historical Society. In all, over 120,000 lives are covered by our programs. The Employee Insurance Division of Dewar administers the State Employee Group Insurance Program. It is through the State Employee Group Insurance Program that the state offers its employee benefits. Clarifying the first section and contracting authority. Currently, the law allows us or requires us to contract with a licensed carrier. This was something that we had done all along until such time as we went self-insured in 2000. At that time, we probably should have clarified the law, but we did not. Since we have been self-insured, we are contracting with the subsidiaries of licensed health insurance carriers. So for all practical purposes, the section just clarifies that we can contract with these subsidiaries of the licensed carriers. Moving on, the next section we've withdrawn, and then the next section deals with providing insurance benefits to retirees, and I'm going to ask a retiree to come and help us with that. Currently, the department is required to provide an actuarially equivalent health plan for retirees. This means that the plan we provide must be actuarially equivalent, and please don't ask me to define that, to that provided to the active employees. What that is doing is causing the cost of our supplemental plan to be ever more expensive, and former employees, retirees, are able to go out and purchase individual policies on their own for a far better price. Mm-hmm. So what we'd like to do is give us the option to offer plans that are not actuarially equivalent, that do supplement the retirees' Medicare insurance, and make the plan more flexible and economically feasible for former employees to purchase. What we currently have is an expensive plan, and it is becoming too expensive for many to continue in it. I'd like to hand it over to Doug Muhorter, a retiree.
Mr. Muhorter, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Douglas Muhorter. I'm the business manager for the Retired State Employees Association. We're an organization of 8,000 dues-paying members, all retirees from all the different plans administered by the Minnesota State Retirement System. Every fall, when the insurance letter goes out showing the increase in premiums, I get 2 to 3 dozen telephone calls from retirees saying, this is just getting too expensive. Why can't the state offer a lower price plan with higher deductibles, higher co-payments, so that I can afford to stay with the state plan? Because I like being in the group. I like being part of the state where I worked all those 30 years, whatever. And I would like, you know, the extra protection of having the state kind of oversee the insurance. So they like the idea of the group. So they would like a lower cost, higher deductible plan, And all I can do when they call is explain the restriction that keeps that from happening. Also want to mention that in my former career, I worked 35 years with the Minnesota State Retirement System, and I know that as current employees come up upon retirement, health insurance and its costs are always a big issue, and these are probably the most critical group, so that as they come up upon retirement, they have the opportunity to stay in the state plan, and a group provision would be good. Right now, about half of, or over half of retirees have, are leaving the state plan or have left the state plan because it just doesn't meet their needs as far as what it provides and what it costs. So the Minnesota Retired State Employees Association supports this change in the law to provide a lower cost insurance track as an alternative to the current, so that people could choose, give them more choices. And we like this as an option for retirees. And the Department of Employee Relations insurance people have talked about this with our board members back and forth over the past few years, and we're glad to see it come to the front. Thank you.
Any questions from members?
Madam Chair?
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the last testifier, you indicated, do the changes in the law allow an option for the retiree? Is that what you're explaining?
That's correct. As I read it, the change would allow them to offer a new separate insurance benefit with higher deductibles and co-payments and lower cost. Then they could choose that instead of the higher coverage, more expensive plan that they now have. Our understanding is that both would be available to them. There'd be two different tracks they could go down.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give me an example of a person? Could you give me an example of what is taking place now? Person has worked for 25 years or whatever else the case may be, or been a legislator for 18 or 20 years or 30 years or whatever the case may be. And then explain to me what retirement program would they have.
Mr. Muehlhalter.
Okay, as they come up on retirement under the insurance program, they could continue in the state plan, and say it was somebody in greater Minnesota, they would likely have to choose, they would have their Medicare coverage, and they would likely to have to choose something that cost about $325 a month to provide a supplement to Medicare for their hospitalization and doctor. You have people out there who maybe don't take a lot of medication that's not generic. They're in good health. They can't see paying $325 a month for this coverage. They like to have something down in the $150 range, which they can probably find on the outside through an insurance policy, and that would not give them the coverage for their medicines and so forth, but it might be sufficient for them. And that's the kind of folks who are leaving the plan.
Follow up, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you. What is the value of passing this particular piece of legislation? The reason why I'm concerned about it is because it'll go to this community. I don't know how it will, whether or not it'll pass here or not, but my point being is I'll assume that it will. What is the advantage to this bill over what now exists?
The advantage is that retired state employees like the idea of the kind of community that they've had with the state. They like the idea of being in a group plan, because generally group plans are going to do better for you financially. And they like the idea that the state is keeping an eye on it, that Liz and her folks are keeping an eye on the policy and the company, whatever, and gives them an extra margin of safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Holden, I have a question then related to any cost savings to the state. Do you see that on this bill here?
Madam Chair, no, there are no cost savings to the state. The state does not contribute to the retiree health so there are no cost savings.
Thank you. Question, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Holden, I'm a little confused about the language in the bill in that we're striking a mandate to offer an actuarially equivalent plan and substituting may, so it becomes an option. And what I heard the witness describing is that they would actually like to have and expect to have two options, one of which would be actuarially equivalent and one of which would have higher deductibles and copays. And the language as it is right here would just give complete discretion as to whether or not anything would be offered as I look at it. I'm not quite sure that that was the intent, but I don't see that there would retain an option for an actuarial equivalent one and a different one, that we'd actually be expanding options. So that may be the intent. I'm not sure that the language is clear that that's the result you expect out of this law change. Am I correct in understanding that's the desired option is to have two plans?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, it is to have two plans, one that is more cost-effective for employees, plus the option to be that is actuarially equivalent, the high-cost option.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Loeffler.
Yeah, I think if that's the intent, we should probably revise the language so that it shall offer an actuarially equivalent plan and may offer a lower-cost, high-deductible plan, because I think that's the intent of the organization.
And actually, if I could have Mr. Shepard make a comment on that. Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, members, and Representative Loeffler, I think that... your suggestion is correct, that if the committee wanted to ensure that the department did offer one lower-cost plan, that it might be wise to add that language at the end of the line on page 6, line 18. It would be up to the committee if you wanted to. You could consider reinstating the shall on line 14 if you wanted to make sure that that occurred, and deleting the may. If you did that, it would read... You would add at the end of line 18 that language to the effect of and either may or shall offer at least one lower cost plan, and that would leave the commissioner substantial flexibility on how to do that. I can, Madam Chair, I would write that up if the committee is interested in that.
Sure. Let's continue with questions, and we'll come back to that amendment here in a few minutes. Representative Loeffler, did you have a follow-up?
No, I think I would like to move that amendment if the author doesn't want to.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, when Mr. Shepard is done writing that, I think you'll find that we'll be happy to accept it as a so-called friendly amendment.
Okay.
We'd be happy to do that.
We'll come back to that in a couple minutes then. Other questions from members? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Representative Beard, on page 1, line 16, when you're talking about your striking language that talks about carriers licensed under Chapter 62A, 62C, and D, two questions. Are we getting rid of licensed carriers, and what does 62A, B, and A, C, and D do? Why are you taking that out? Maybe I'm sorry, I was a little late, and I don't know if you were covering that.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I think that Ms. Holding touched on that in her opening description of this section of the bill. However, I did not have an easy read of Chapters 62A, C, and D last night. So let's ask the department if they can explain that to us. Maybe Ms. Holding, or maybe she has some other resources.
Ms. Holding.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, Chapter 62, A, C, and D are the regulatory chapters overseen by the Departments of Health and Commerce, and the carriers are licensed with the Departments of Health and Commerce, as we have done business with them in the past. As I indicated, in 2000, we went fully self-insured, and as a result, we are getting administrative services and networks of providers, hospitals, doctors, from subsidiaries of these licensed carriers in two cases. And we would just like to clarify that we have the ability to contract with the subsidiary rather than the actual licensed carrier.
Thank you.
Any follow-up? Other questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Holden. I'm still a little concerned about whether or not we're going to have sufficient safeguards for the employees who are expecting here, because those chapters are, you know, the viability of the insurance carrier and, you know, that they agree to operate under certain kind of rules and things. And so I'm wondering if their subsidiary, I know that self-insured, you don't have to worry about the reserves and some of those other sorts of things, but I'm wondering if there's some other components there about, you know, appeal rights of, you know, health decisions, some other sorts of things that would be in those chapters that we would still want to have there, and that maybe you, if it's true, if the subsidiaries really come under those chapters, if there shouldn't still be a reference to them. The other thing that I had a question about is on page 2, there's a provision that says the commissioner may not elect to offer a health HMO services to an employer who resides in an area which is not served by a licensed HMO, and that seems to provide some, you know, for people who live in areas where there aren't as many health care providers, some guaranteed access to the local providers, and I would assume that we'd want to retain that sort of commitment to our employees, that if you live in an area that doesn't have the kind of HMO or health plan type competition, the big networks that are interested in them because of the scarcity of the population, that we'd continue to offer them a health plan that met their needs.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we are required by statute, and I can't give you the specific site, to follow all of the mandates and rules and regulations as are required by the licensed carriers in the state. So we do have that requirement already existing in the statutes.
Madam Chair, I believe the statement is modeled pretty closely after what happens in private industry. There are several large companies that are self-insured and merely hire an outside company to administer the paperwork for claims and adjustments and so on and so forth. And I think the state is laboring under the same contractual obligations, same statutory obligations as they are.
Follow-up? Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Just a quick follow-up. How about the question about the geographic scarcity of providers? Is that also addressed in some way in our contracting?
Ms. Foley?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. Yes, our... And now we're getting into a little bit more difficult area, but we are required through the union contracts to provide coverage throughout the state. So that is something that we bargain with the unions of where the providers are located for all of the state employees. So it isn't necessarily in the statute that as we, you know, that we're looking at, but it is a requirement in the bargaining process.
Thank you.
Again,
Representative Beard.
Just a thought on that. Whenever we contract with an HMO, the HMOs aggregated the providers that were in their system and said, this is where you will go. If there was an area of the state where there wasn't a provider, then we had to have some other accommodation. In this case, the state, through its contracted management team, actually is picking and choosing, I guess, where you can go, or describing the coverage is a better way to say it. We're not locked into an HMO-type system here. We're locked into more of a pure health insurance program type of thing because we're self-insured. we actually get to pick and choose the policy and the descriptions, the parameters, and so on and so forth.
Okay. I know we've got an amendment. Excuse me?
I said I hope that clarifies things a bit on that point. Was good.
I know we've got an amendment coming up. I have a question here before we get to that. Relating to the A2 amendment,
mm-hmm.
and the timing for how this works, I'm wondering about people who are former legislators now who at the time they retired understood that this would be available later. Do they get grandfathered in? Is there a way to notify them? How does that work with this new legislation? Ms. Holden?
Madam Chair, we're unable to notify former legislators because we do not know where they're located. However, we do feel...
They're usually in the audience.
We do feel...
Ms. Holden.
It is the responsibility of the former legislators to know the law, and this would be the law.
Okay.
Madam Chair, are you prepared to speak about the E2 amendment for a few moments?
Sure. Representative McNamara, is it to this point or to the bill? Or?
Madam Chair, to this point, but I got a feeling Representative Beard is going to elaborate on that.
Sure.
It just rose a very, very big red flag with the testifier's answer to that. I have a hard time thinking that we're going to hold all ex-legislators responsible to know what we're doing here or in the room at the Capitol. I'm nervous for them.
Representative Beard.
Yes, Madam Chair, when I was first approached and we talked the bill over about carrying this bill for the Department of Employee Relations, one of the benefits that's out there, one of the little perks, if you will, for being in the legislature, and Lord knows there's precious few perks left here in this place except for the privilege of running for re-election every 2 years. One of the ones that's still kind of out there that most of us don't know about is that when we leave this place, at any point going forward in the future, a year from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, I could chip a tooth, pick up the phone and call Doer and pay my monthly premium for my dental bill, go get my teeth fixed, and then the next month not pay the premium. Or replace my knee, or pick any one of a myriad of things that could happen to us. So it, unlike the way the state employees are treated, and I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Holding to describe the process accurately, but instead of, you know, whenever we're not elected anymore, we can continue to pay the premiums and have the insurance if we wish, just like any other state employee, we can actually let years go by when lapses in our premium and then come back in, turn it on in a moment's notice, enjoy the benefit, and then go away again. This presents a couple of problems. One is, of course, the fairness issue of not paying our premiums when we're healthy and coming in and paying a couple months, extracting the benefit and spreading the costs over the remaining state employee base. There's a fairness issue there. The other one is the administrative headache of trying to keep track of some of us. Now, a bunch of us keep hanging around here and know what's going on. Some of us retire to Texas and are never heard from again. So how is the Department of Administration supposed to administer this program? There's two issues here I think we need to talk about. And this is the fun issue I was telling you about earlier. So I hope you're all awake for this discussion. I'd like to ask Ms. Holding to elaborate a little more on the details, Madam Chair.
Ms. Holding.
Madam Chair. Members of the committee, former executive branch state employees, including agency heads and constitutional officers, have a one-time limited window of opportunity in which to enroll in the state's health care coverage. Once the former employees leave the program, they may not rejoin. The purpose of this limitation is to help hold down the cost of health care. If members, be they former or retired members, are allowed to come and go from the program, the sickest will stay in the program and the healthy will leave, returning only when they need services. The result of this scenario is that premiums skyrocket as only the high-costing members stay and those costs are spread across a smaller group. In the state program, there's one exception to the continuous membership rule, and that is for the former legislators. They may rejoin at any time for the rest of their lives. We feel that this creates an inequity, and we would like to see it corrected with this language.
There's a question. Representative Connors first.
Madam Chair, I guess maybe it's just to Mark. I think I understand it, but if we pass this, a former legislator who's out of the system now could get back in before this became law. This section became it wouldn't depend on their time that they had retired from the legislature.
Ms. Holding?
I completely agree that it's an unfair benefit and it should be changed, but I wonder
Madam Chair, as I understand, the effective date of this law would be August 1st, 2005. So there would be a window between whenever it passes the House and the Senate to August 1st for these folks to be notified or become aware of this and get back on the plan, start paying their premiums, or kiss a goodbye, I guess.
But my understanding from Ms. Holden's earlier comments is that there would be no notification step taken other than through their own.
Madam Chair, I don't expect the Department Administration to go out and look for these folks. It'll be published just the way the rest of us learn about it, session weekly, public meetings, so on and so forth.
Thank you. I have a list of questions here. Next up, Ruth Johnson, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Holden, I absolutely agree with Representative Kahn that there is a philosophical unfairness that is embodied in current law. Can you give us examples where this unfairness has been played out in fact?
Ms. Holden?
If you could leave names, actual names and Social Security numbers out of the discussion, that would be good.
Ms. Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, we know that there are former legislators who are taking advantage of this program. They do come and go, but they do not ever, and we do not want to know what the circumstances are for their coming and going. But we do have records because they must re-enroll in our program. And we do have records of employees coming and going as the need arises in their individual case.
Follow-up, Ms. Representative Johnson.
It had never occurred to me, Representative Beard, that someone would step back into the program in order to cover something massively expensive and then bow out once that had been taken care of. So I recognize the problem there. It just had never occurred to me that anybody would do such a thing. It seems unfair in its own right. And I was just wondering if there has been, if you could assign a ballpark dollar figure or any kind of measure of frequency or abuse that we might give us a factual peg to hang this idea on.
Ms. Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, unfortunately, because we do not have claim information and do not track information on an individual basis, we cannot give you the value of this. We just have the records of people re-enrolling and disenrolling. So the claim information is not available for us to find out this kind of information.
One final follow-up. But the rapidity of the turnover or the frequency of the turnover seems to be a red light. Is that an accurate way of describing why this came to discussion, Ms. Holden?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, the frequency with which people come and go from the program is the red light.
Thank you.
And a whole list here. Next up, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back to the red light. Fairly simply, can you just tell us, is this happening once a year, or is this happening with one person once a year, or 10 people 10 times a year? Because you alluded to the premiums becoming horrendous because of past legislators jumping back in and getting back out. I don't know how many of us there are and how much we're driving, that particular group is driving up the premiums. It sounds like you can't tell us. But maybe you can tell us the number of times it happens, which is creating this red light.
Ms. Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, when I reviewed our records, I saw a number of individuals on an annual basis coming back into the program for one time, for 1 month, and then getting out of the program. And I can think of three or four of the former legislators who did this on a regular basis.
Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Mahoney.
So what you're saying is there's three or four legislators that are creating a problem. What happens to, let's say that I lose my next election and I go back to being a pipe fitter and I get on the pipe fitter's health insurance, but at age 59 I want to retire, and the state plan is cheaper or better or both than my pipe fitter's plan at you know, and I've been out of the legislature 5 years. Can I, at that time, come back and get into the plan, the state plan, or I'm not going to be able to?
Ms. Holding.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. Once out, always out.
So then,
Representative.
So, Representative Beard, how come you don't like us? You know, we don't have an awful lot of perks left of this particular job. Overworked, underpaid. I love doing it. I plan on doing it as long as I can. But now you're picking on us again. Are you trying for that popularity contest?
Representative Baird, would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, I am merely the pack horse carrying the doer bill, so if Representative Mahoney wants to smite me, that's his privilege to do that. However, seriously, if I can talk about this, in thinking about the way we progressed this morning, I knew that this would be the one that would engender most of the discussion. Perhaps it would have been better for me to offer the A2 amendment as a standalone amendment, because I know we need to talk this through. Yes, my previous comments about there are precious few perks left. This is one of them. Most of us, I'm willing to bet around this table, did not know it existed until this moment. Am I happy to take it out? Not really. There is, however, the fairness issue of spreading the premium cost. That's how insurance works, that we need to talk through. If there is a perk for us to be to hold on to, I wouldn't be ashamed to argue on behalf of it. I'm not emotionally attached to this amendment. I think it's a good thing for us to talk through. And if the amendment needs to be modified, Mr. Chairman, so that perhaps there is, after we retire from our other civilian life, a chance to come back into the program or something like that, well, I'm certainly willing to have this held over and talked through some more. As I'm making that comment, I'm remembering one of the previous testifiers, Mr. Merwarder, I believe it was, who talked about a plan that retirees can get on through the State Association of Retired Employees, I believe it was called. And I'm wondering if that's available to us as legislators after we leave our civilian lives. I don't know who to frame that question to. It's just a thought that I'm thinking about.
Representative Wardlow, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of making sure previous legislators are notified, why not make it so that if you get out of the program and then the next time you try to get back in, you get notified at that time. You're in now, but if you leave again, you're done. Something to that effect.
Representative Beard, would you like to respond to that? Is there a possibility of an amendment to the amendment here?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, if the collective intelligence or experience of this body is that perhaps we do want to have a one-time, you can come in later, but you got to keep the premiums up and stay there or something like that. I'm not speaking for the department, mind you. I'm speaking as a legislator, so I have a dog in this fight, I've got to tell you. And I think at this stage of the discussion, I don't know that there's questions and answers going on. I think there's brainstorming going on and freewheeling. Now, I like that kind of discussion, but I know this is a public meeting, so sometimes unintended consequences come from brainstorming and thinking, freewheeling. So I don't know that I have an answer. I've just had some thoughts, and I really am looking to the collective will of this committee to form this piece of the bill.
Ms. Holden, would you like to address that issue, or is there someone from Dewar here that would like to address that particular issue? Okay.
Mr. Chair, we certainly would be willing to work with you on this amendment.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, this is the fun part of this, because we're the policymakers. Ms. Holding and Commissioner Ludeman and so on are the administrators who carry out the policy that we make. They've asked us to address this and explain to us the cost issue and the fairness issue and the workload issue of trying to keep track of erstwhile legislators as they move around the globe. And so really it's up to us to decide how we want to handle this, where we want to go with this benefit. Perk is more of a purgatorial phrase. Let's use the word benefit. So let me just offer this as food for thought. If this is a good idea today, it'll be a good idea tomorrow. I'm quoting my grandpa. If it's the will of this committee to lay this bill over for a day and mull this over and come back with something suggested, I personally would be very happy to do that. I don't think the department's going to come grinding to a halt if we talk about this a little more. I don't think so. They're good people. They can continue issuing checks and things like that. So I'm just going to throw that out, and let's talk about it for a few more minutes would be my suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Beard. And I guess it would be kind of my intention as well at this point, if we have a good open discussion here, that we would probably lay it over on the table, have those amendments fashioned, and then bring it back off the table, add the amendment, and then discuss the bill at the end there. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney, again, you and I tend to agree on everything, and so it's real good to see. Representative Beard, I think you've brought forward some real important thoughts. This coming in and out in what I would call probably gross misuse of a system by a few is unfortunate, and I think we definitely need to rein that in. I had a couple of ideas that I'd like to present and modify your A2 amendment, and I was talking to Mr. Shepard, and I think I would, he has my ideas, and if it would be okay, or do you not us to want to even modify it, Representative Beard? My idea is that we allow a one-time opportunity for the legislator to jump in, but not to be 30 days, to be 2 years. So all those that are currently retired, we'd make an effective date 2 years for them, and then any future legislators would have 2 years to plant trees or fix pipes, and if they decided then they wanted to be part of their state plan, they could have a one-time opportunity to get back. I guess that's my thoughts. I don't know if you'd rather do that as an author or just wait. I defer to you, Representative Beard, at this point.
Representative Beard, to that point.
Mr. Chair, I think that's worth mulling over as well. I've been in committees where we've made up complicated amendments on the fly. Good things have not generally come from that process. And again, I just would tell you, if any of these ideas are a good idea today, they'll be a good idea tomorrow or next Tuesday or whenever the chair wants to bring them back up again. I see that Representative Kahn is, looks like she got...
We had three other people that are ahead. Representative Loeffler.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that if we're looking for solutions to a problem, it does seem to me like you can deal with it in terms of saying people can only join in and cannot discontinue coverage until the next open enrollment period, or, you know, that you have the one-time only opt-in sort of options. And it seems like you can solve that. But, I mean, I think current employees aren't allowed to suddenly drop in and out of health insurance, and we shouldn't have that authority for anybody to jump in and out. And so I was just going to suggest that there might be some other ways, if that's the real issue you're trying to solve. We might look at ways that have to be continuously enrolled for a year, or the, you know, you only get in once, that sort of thing. But I think there's some other options, and I'm pleased that there's willingness to be creative here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
I think Representative Loeffler's suggestion about utilizing the open enrollment period is one that has some merit here, too. Perhaps that could be part of the fix.
And Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments have changed about three times since I raised my hand in the conversation here. I think the policy that we're trying to work on makes a lot of sense. Representative Beard, I guess I'm in spirit with you on this thing, to be able to jump in and out. Representative Loeffler comes up with a nice idea, too, I think. What we're after here is the in-and-out thing. Doesn't make sense. I don't think that's good policy, whether it's, even if it is for us, it's a good thing. I agree with the essence of what Lunger brainstorming here. I agree with the essence of Representative McNamara, and I'm trying to think about, you know, maybe even in an election process, a couple of years or whatever, because, you know, oftentimes it's a little different for us than from judges. We lose an election, and I think 30 days is much too short to make that decision. I just think, you know, we need a little more time than that. And then I thought in terms of, well, if somebody loses an election and comes back in a couple of years and runs again, maybe there should be some, again, taking out the in-and-out thing, an opportunity to get in if you lose that second election. Mm-hmm. Of course, then it complicates things. I think this affects senators also, and that's a four-year deal, so... food for thought, Representative Beard. I think we're on the right track here, but I like your idea of giving some time to this.
Representative Beard. And Representative Kahn?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, my question, I think you answered this, but let me just ask it again. Is there any other retirement plans that anybody knows of that has this? I mean, there are private retirement plans, there are local public plans, and so forth. does anyone allow this in and out of the ability to purchase after benefit?
Representative Beard.
Sidebar here regarding the whether or not elected officials could be in and out into a plan like Mr. Muhorter?
Muhorter
just described, and apparently that is not available to that option. Having been a private employer with employees in a health plan, I can just imagine the reaction of my insurance agent if I called and asked if I could pay premiums this month because I had a sick employee and let's drop July, August, and September. I'd get laughed right out of his office. It just doesn't work that way. It kind of flies in the face of the principle underlying insurance, you know, pooling our resources to look out for each other. And so when you think about that argument for why this works and why we provide benefits for our employees and ourselves, this kind of coverage, the idea of being able to cherry pick a bad month for coverage flies in the face of that also. It gets to the fairness issue. So really, are there two things I guess I'd like to ask us to mull over here as I'm kind of coming to a conclusion. One is the fairness issue. What's the right thing to do? And bearing in mind that we do hold a rather unique position as elected officials, and so we, you know, don't shy away from a thought that maybe there should be some opportunity in the future for us to come back in. The second one, though, is the work we afflict the department with of keeping track of how it works. So whatever solution we craft to this or whatever policy we decide to pursue, let's make sure that from an administrative perspective it's actually workable for folks. You follow me? Follow the second point there?
I'm sorry, Ms. Representative Beard, I got diverted.
There were just a couple comments and food for thought here, Mr. Chair. Okay. I'm sorry I ended my comments with a question mark because it acts like I was asking you a question.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Kahn, follow up?
Well, just continuing, you know, the question that I asked is, does this exist anywhere that anyone knows of? We don't have it for other state elected officials. We only see the judges in front of us. But other state elected officials can't do it. Legislative staff can't do it. I'm interested if, you know, going beyond that, are there any other, and do other legislators elsewhere in the country have this?
Ms. Holden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm unaware of whether other legislators in the country have this, and I'm unaware of what other cities or local units of government might do. I can tell you in terms of the state, the former legislators are the only ones who have the ability to opt in and out of our program.
Representative Kahn, follow up.
No, I would actually, I don't know if there's some easy way of getting that information, but I think it's relevant.
Sure.
You know, does every 49 other legislators have this, and we're just taking away something that people consistently have? Do cities have it somewhere? This is the only one that operates in this way. I think people would think very seriously about whether they want to vote to retain what's obviously a very big perk in the days of very expensive medical procedures.
Representative Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, maybe I'm a little out of context here because I think I got skipped before. But I just want to say that even if this isn't a problem in terms of a lot of numbers of people using it, it's just really troubling to me to hear that we have this benefit. Responding a bit to Representative Kahn, it doesn't really matter to me if 49 other states are doing it. I guess I want to know what the real need is here, because this is a time when we're talking about tossing a lot of our citizens off of their health care insurance. And here, this benefit we're talking about is one that I don't think I certainly didn't know about it. I would venture to guess not many members of this committee did. And, you know, certainly nothing that anybody would expect to have. I appreciate a lot of the discussion here about ways to tailor this, but what kind of comes down for me is, you know, what is the real need for this at all? I mean, do we have a need to have legislators really have any different set of expectations than regular state employees have? I mean, maybe as Representative Demmer said, maybe we do need a little extra time more than the 30 days just because of the nature of the way we lose our jobs and kind of the suddenness of that sometimes, and that you might need more than 30. You might, yeah, you got a mourning period. You might need more than 30 days to kind of adjust and decide what you want to do. But other than that, I, unless there's a real good reason, I don't think that we should take that kind of a benefit. I just don't think it sends the right message, and certainly in the climate that we're in now. And I'm just wondering, does anybody know how that got put in the first place, or what the rationale was for it when it was established, other than just being a perk?
Ms. Holding, to that point.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at Mark Shepard, and he said, no, I don't have any information about the history.
And Representative Seifert?
We're talking about 1 year or 2 years. I'm just wondering what would a monthly premium be for a retired legislator?
Ms. Holden.
Monthly or annually, whatever. Do you have any rough idea what it might be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, the current monthly premium is, for a single individual, $368.
A follow-up, Representative Seifert?
I'm just calculating out, I'll have to do this later, but if someone opted in for a $15,000 knee surgery, it would take quite a while to... the whole premise of insurance is pooling and risk management. Mm-hmm. And I understand people want to compromise on this, but I don't think a one-year thing is... It's still... I don't know if it follows in line with things, but I'm just thinking about that.
And Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beard. What next do we do? What next do we as legislators do? We just decide that we have to work for free?
Is that
don't you? No, it's a rhetorical question. Don't you folks understand how important you are to this particular organization? I don't understand this. This is, every year I jump in and jump out because of my pipe fitter insurance. So, all of a sudden, you don't want people to run for office. You don't want to pay them for office. You understand, you as legislators, more than anyone understand how hard this job is. And now all of a sudden you want to take away one of the last things that actually makes this job worth it beyond just the pride of serving the state? If this comes back, I'm going to offer the amendment that we go without pay and without insurance. That's exactly what we keep hearing, that we are not worth getting paid, we are not worth getting insured, we don't do a good job. And you all know that it's a lie, and I hope this is on tape, because I'm a little tired of everyone coming to the Capitol, everyone going to the press, and calling politicians no good, lousy scums, and shouldn't be paid in the first place. We do a very good job. We do a very hard job. We do it for long hours. And this is one of the few things that's left when we leave this place. Because the pension isn't worth a hill of beans as far as I'm concerned. So, Representative Beard, I'm sorry. I'm going to vote against any form of this thing coming back. And I hope every member of this committee votes against any form of this coming back. Because until the committee hears the actual cost, because you apparently either can't or won't tell us that this costs $1,000 a year or it costs $100,000 a year, it makes no sense. You're telling us to take a vote without giving us any information other than we think it costs a lot. But really what we're telling you is that we don't like having to administrate it. I'm sorry that this has come up. I think it's a wrong idea. And I think it's almost insulting to every legislator. It tells us that we have no value and we shouldn't be paid. It's just part of that ongoing pillaring of public officials. And that's not a question.
And I've got one more question here, and then what I'd like to do is put the Mr. Shepard's amendment on here, and then we will table it, hopefully with the... future proposal, if you could possibly, Ms. Holden, come up with some of the numbers that we've had in the past. I'm sorry, layover. Come up with some of the numbers in the past that perhaps the last 3 or 4 years were some of the fiscal note that we've experienced in that process. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't quite take the same bully pulpit, but I do appreciate those comments. I think, again, I'm going to make a rhetorical statement. I am a little troubled by using the word benefit perk. At the same time, we are always trying to figure out how we can take our citizenry and put them into some kind of an insurance safety net so that they don't end up on our public health rolls. And I see this as really as just a safety net benefit that young Mr. Welty could come in and out of the service and by the time he reaches in later years could opt in as a safety net into a major program that his employer may not provide him. Or that somebody else here could come in here for 5 or 6 years during their productive lives and then have to go back into the marketplace and try to pick up time in a career that would allow them to opt into insurance program. And there are many major employers that allow this option for retired employees. There are several cities who allow this option for retired employees. And I'm going to suggest, I don't want to call it a perk because it's not a perk. You will pay the same premiums the state pays, and maybe there's a modified benefit that they're suggesting, which I agree with, but it is a safety net. For serving the public, you can opt back in. Now, if you want to stop something, maybe the in and out is the abuse. I understand that. That's a no-brainer. Okay. You opt in. If you opt out, you maybe do it twice, and once you're out, you're out. But I would certainly hate to preclude somebody from this body serving here 2 years, 10 years, 12 years, and then 20 years later not being able to get into an insurance pool, and we end up with some significant human service delivery. So I agree with Mr. Mahoney, and I would urge us to be very careful about just suggesting that we're doing some, quote, house cleaning against this legislature. That is a wrong attitude from my perspective.
Seeing no more questions, is there anybody from the audience that would want to testify?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Wilty. The new guys always get me. Representative Wilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peterson would yield for a question, I'd like to direct a question to him.
I called you young. Is that an issue? In my sort of all young.
No.
Representative Peterson.
My question is this, and that is, you were talking about some cities and other entities that you know of that offer these benefits where you can opt in and then you can opt back out. Is this in the same manner as what we currently have in statute, or is this something a little bit different? I want to understand if there's anything else out there in the public sector that allows you to opt in when you become sick and then opt out after you receive the treatment.
Yeah, that's a good question. The opting in and opting out is the abuse of the privilege. And I think most of them, you can opt in later. You can work for a company or a community after so many years, you can opt in to getting back into their program 20 years later. But then if you do select opting out, then you're out. So I would stand corrected on that one. But being able to come back into a major program as a safety net 10, 15, 20 years later, that's a privilege I think we should encourage, because we want our citizenry to get back into an insurance program that maintains them at the time they're extremely vulnerable. But again, opting in and out, that is an abuse of the system.
Representative Wilson.
Sure, and just to follow up with that, and this won't be a question for Representative Peterson, but as I look at it right now, I agree with you. I think that you should have the ability to opt in at some point, but I don't think that you should have the ability to opt out right after you've received the treatment or after the care. And I'm wondering, can we look at what we currently offer to our employees in the state when they can opt back in, or other programs where you can opt back in, and can we model something that's similar to that and come back with legislation that we can say this works? And why it works. I would suggest that for Representative Beard. And I thank you for bringing this point up, and I thank you for the intent of your bill.
Commissioner Ruben, welcome to our committee, and please state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Cal Ludeman. I'm the Commissioner of Employee Relations for the state of Minnesota. thank you for the opportunity to say a few words about this. I'm also a former legislator, who enjoys this benefit also. But I think it's important, and I think we have to be a little careful on how we talk about this. As Ms. Holding said, our access to individualized claims data is a dangerous thing for the employer to have, and we don't have that, but we do. So we need to talk about this a little bit anecdotally, at least from what my knowledge is. We do have retired legislators who do go in and out, which I think is one of the issues. But I also know of situations where the entrance to the back into the CGIP plan was the day of the heart attack. And so the cost incurred on the behalf of that now new CGIP member rings up to several hundred thousands of dollars. And they're more than willing to pay that premium for the rest of their life because it's now still pretty good value. If everyone enjoyed this benefit, no one would buy insurance. And so that the whole point is that no other state employee has this benefit. It is to the preservation of the pool to keep the insurance program alive, to not necessarily keep its administrative cost down. It's to keep the claims or experience under some control. Now, I've said that anecdotally. I know it to be true, so you can't press me any farther, and I will not answer that specific question about one person. But this is one case where you had the option to go in, and you never intended to go back out. So that one-time option to go back in is a crucial knowledge that you would have to have to be able to insure yourself against this catastrophic event that many people buy insurance for. So I urge my legislative friends, of which I am of that former community at least, to be at least knowledgeable about what this is in distincting yourself from the rest of the population. And that's why this issue is before us. I would say that in Representative Beard, who certainly we appreciate bringing this legislation forward and bringing this knowledge to the legislature, maybe there is another way. I can think of, for example, for a laid-off state employee, I guess in a legislative sense, maybe one who lost an election, there is a continuation of employer-paid benefits for 6 months. I don't know if the legislature could pay for those benefits. I doubt it. But at least that eligibility would be maintained, and you actually have that now. If you lost an election, you can continue CGIP participation for the rest of your life. You would have to pay the premium, however. Whether you can make that decision in 30 days before you're not any longer eligible or not, I guess, is the question that Representative Demmer brought up. But that's sort of what I think is the parameters of this discussion. And it is so different from anybody else's member of CGIP that I think it's important this legislature to consider. We think it's an important piece of legislation.
Representative Kahn, to that point?
Well, I think what Representative Peterson said was the question that I asked, was that I wanted, and he seemed to believe that it is, and I have no reason to doubt him, that it isn't an option for municipal employees. But I would like, from what I know about insurance, and I've been working on this on insurance issues in another way, it just seems so anathema to any rational insurance plan that I kind of can't believe it. So that's why I asked it. And Representative Liebling, I didn't ask it expecting to find that 49 other states did it. I asked that question expecting to probably find that 49 other states didn't do it, which is a different kind of information, although you did take it to the... but I just think if this is a good idea, then we ought to give it to the general public in some sense, and just kind of looking at that. But the other issue, sorry to pick on Andy, but... He deserves it. That's what I mean, yeah. But the point is, with the kind of insurance that you purchase and that you need when you're 25 is very different than the kind of insurance that you might want when you're 65. And we do have the ability to purchase some long-term disability insurance. And isn't that under a limited offering period? I don't quite know how that does. And doesn't that depend on...
Doesn't that depend on some of the usual insurance parameters that we see, such as age?
Commissioner Rubin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, that's true. We have both the long-term disability insurance, which is an open enrollment event on the part of all state employees and legislators, but also long-term care insurance is offered to the state of Minnesota. So you have insurance options, but as in all of the insurance world, it's best to make these choices early and often.
But there is a difference in as you get to choose them on the state level. There is a difference at what age you are when you choose them, isn't there? Is there a difference in the price? There is a difference in the price, yes.
Any other discussion? At this point, I'd like to ask Mr. Shepherd to go ahead and verbalize that amendment, if you would.
Mr. Chair and members, this does not address the legislator issue. This addresses the issue that Representative Loeffler brought up earlier, which is the plan that is available to all retired state employees, to which Mr. Muhorter spoke. And Representative Loeffler asked for an amendment that would require the commissioner to continue to offer at least one plan that's actuarially equivalent to those for current state employees, but to add another lower cost plan. And to implement that, Mr. Chair, I would suggest on page 6, line 14, to delete the word may and insert must. And then on page 6, line 18, before the period, insert comma and must offer at least one lower cost plan. The effect of that would be that for retired state employees, the commissioner would offer the current version, which is actuarially equivalent, and then the commissioner would be required to offer at least one lower cost plan. I do have that written down, and I'll give it to Ms. Davis if the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. And Representative Beard, would you take that as a friendly amendment?
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to accept that as a friendly amendment, and thanks Representative Loeffler for suggesting it.
You have to move it. Move it.
Since the author has taken it up.
We
can't
incorporate it.
We can't incorporate it.
Mr. Loeffler, offer it, and we'll just vote it on.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, perhaps for the crispness and the cleanness, and just to hear every member, perhaps I should withdraw the offer to accept it, and we should just discuss and vote it up or down. Let's do it the official way.
You're graced with an inexperienced chair is magnanimous. Having the amendment brought forward by Representative Loeffler, any discussion, further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lubin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had another kind of question that maybe goes to the language of the bill that you've got here. On the first page, on line 16 through 19, we've got this stricken language, and there was some discussion about this before, that as I understood it, the intent was to be able to negotiate with people who may not be licensed carriers under these chapters. And I was thinking if the intent here was to just open it up so that the department could negotiate with others who don't fall under this, I don't read the stricken language as preventing that. As I read this line, it just says the commissioner may negotiate premium rates and coverage with all carriers licensed. Do you read that language as precluding the negotiating with others who may not be licensed?
Representative Beard. Ms. Holding?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to speak expertly. This is not an attorney. What I am is the backhorse carrying this bill, and I know some pretty high-powered people that understand this negotiation contracting language have looked extensively at this. Out of respect for my colleague, we could call some of them forward to explain what this means. But I do know this. We are self-insured. We write the checks. The taxpayers put the money in. We write the checks. This permits us to have an outside administrator who's not a licensed bonded insurance company merely administer the paperwork in our plan that we buy, describe, and pay for.
That's my understanding. If you'd like to plow deeper than that, we may have somebody coming that can plow a little deeper.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Holden, do you have...
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's been pointed out to me that the commissioner may negotiate premium rates and coverage, with the licensed carriers, and that's not what we're doing. We're negotiating networks and administrative services.
Representative Lee Lane, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, but I guess, but that's fine. I guess it's not a really big issue, except that I'm just thinking that what the language change here doesn't really, all this does is permit you to do something, and by taking it out, it just seems to me that the agency's no longer permitted to do it. I mean, it doesn't, by striking this language, it doesn't seem like it opens up anything new. But, you know, I'll leave it up. I mean, I just wanted to point that out. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, and you can take it for whatever it's worth.
Having had the copious discussion and amended the bill, 913 as amended, I would at this point lay it over for possible discussion once that amendment has come forward. Representative Beard.
May I make just one closing observation and comment? Members, this is exactly what I had hoped would happen. I knew that there would be a little bit of discussion about this. I deeply appreciate the passion for this place and the work that we do that was ably expressed by Representative Mahoney and seconded by Representative Peterson. And this is, I think, if I can just echo that, the work we do here is noble work. We should be proud to serve in a representative democracy. However, there's also the political side of this equation, the way that we're perceived. And so I just encourage us, as we think about how to craft this A2 portion of the bill, that we carry several things forward, the fairness, the perception, and just what is good policy. Mr. Chair, I'll allow it to the Chair's discretion as when to call this back. In the meantime, I will make you this assurance. I'll do my homework and work with the department and any of you that like to come to my office. Bring chocolate when you come. And let's talk about how we can craft a new A2 amendment that can accomplish what we need to accomplish here in a good way. Okay? So with that, thank you. I'll yield to laying this over for consideration in the future.
Thank you, Representative Beard. And one final comment from Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to let everyone know that I will be preparing a working draft that will incorporate the three amendments that you have. So I'll make that available. If anybody wants to draft further amendments to this bill, it would probably be best to draft it to that new working draft that I'll have available later today.
With that, House File 913 is laid over for future consideration, and Representative Bird, you make an excellent pack horse.
Okay, members, I'm going to move on here. Representative Demers' bill is on the agenda. I don't know if there's anybody in the audience that was going to testify for or against that bill. We do have another item on our agenda here, the overview of the constitutional amendment process, and we sent the page up to get Deb McKnight from House Research because she's not able to return tomorrow. And members, in the meantime, I have an announcement. Actually, it's kind of a sad news. We'll have a moment of silence here in a minute. Just found out today in Iraq there were potentially three Minnesota National Guard members killed, and they're in the 1st Minnesota National Guards, and they were killed they were the first ones killed to date in Iraq from Minnesota. And their unit was from Morris, Minnesota, and they were activated 2 months ago. And the death of First Lieutenant Jason Timmerman of Cottonwood has been confirmed, and there'll be more information on the other two as they become available later today or tomorrow. So with that, members, let's have a moment of silence. Thank you. While we're waiting for Ms. McKnight to arrive, I can put a couple of the members here on the spot. Our three discussion groups that we have, I know that Representative Dempsey's discussion group is getting close to presentation. Maybe if you could just give us a quick update of where you're at, Representative Dempsey.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. We'll, we're hoping to get all of the materials done in regard to the efficiency of government and the plan that the governor has, and working with the committee members, I think we'll be ready on the next time we have a meeting here. I will check with either you or someone else in the committee as to when the finality of that will take place.
Very soon. Thank you, Representative Dempsey. Representative Wardlow, you're now on the Pensions Commission. Maybe if you could just give us a quick update of where you're at with your discussion group. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met one Wednesday morning with Representative Jim Knobloch, and he gave another overview of all the pensions. he spoke quite a bit about the Minneapolis teachers problem. And then tomorrow morning we're going to meet again, and we're going to have a representative, one each from MSRS, PARA, and TRA, and they're going to talk to us about anything we want to ask them.
Good.
And then we'll have another meeting, maybe a follow-up based on some questions that came up, and
good. Thank
try
you.
To formulate.
Appreciate that. And what I'm looking for basically is some kind of presentation to the committee of some of the things that you've learned about, or maybe something more that we should spend some committee time on in the future. The third discussion group is Military Veterans Affairs, Vice Chair Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we've been getting together on Thursdays. We've had quite a conglomerate of interests coming together between the Workforce Center, MNSCU, DPS, licensure boards, and our goal is to really identify those impediments, which you were so gracious to listen to last week a little bit on the one particular bill, to identify those impediments that are not friendly to veterans coming back to Minnesota or who are thinking about staying in Minnesota, and then bringing bills forward if that's necessary or going through the rule process. So we'd be more than happy, probably in about 2 weeks, we'll meet this Thursday again, if it would be the will of the committee to just come forth and just bring a short presentation on some of the proposed bills, some of the things that we're working on at that point.
Great. Thank you very much. And Ms. McKnight should be here shortly from House Research to give us an overview of the constitutional amendment process. We're going to officially move Representative Demmer's bill to tomorrow, and it sounds like that will work with them. House File 973 will be heard tomorrow. And Ms. McKnight, we're ready if you're ready. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, thanks for having me today. I'm Deb McKnight from House Research, and the chair asked me to walk you through the process of ratifying state constitutional amendments, because you have a number of amendments before you this year, and because I recently updated a study that I did some years ago about the ratification process in Minnesota. So what I will do is, at any time, feel free to ask questions, and then to the extent that we have time, I will walk you through the process and tell you a few interesting things that we found in our study about some factors that have an effect on the chances of a question being ratified by the voters. Obviously, the Minnesota Constitution sets the ground rules for its amending itself. There are a couple of provisions in the statutes dealing with ballots and notices. The Constitution requires that an amendment to the Constitution be passed through the legislature, just like any other session law. It has to pass by a simple majority in the House and the Senate. One difference is that it's not signed by the governor. It does not have to be signed by the governor. It cannot be vetoed by the governor. Often, governors sign amendments because they either want to show that they support a particular amendment or they like to be part of the process, but they actually have no role in the amending process under our state constitution. when a constitutional amendment passes the legislature, it's published with the session laws for that year, and it goes on the ballot. It goes to the voters at a general election only. Amendments can be passed either during the election year or during the off year by the legislature. They can be passed in a regular or special session, but they can only go to the voters at a general election. When the statewide ballot is prepared, the Secretary of State also directs the county auditors how to prepare the pink ballot, which is where the constitutional amendments appear in the precincts that use paper ballots. The Secretary gets advice from the Attorney General on a short title that will identify each amendment on the ballot. That's just a sort of a caption, or what we might think of in the legislative process as a headnote. The ballot question itself that goes to the voters is always stated by the legislature in the act that proposed the constitutional amendment. The text of the constitutional amendment does not go on the ballot. All of you have undoubtedly have seen amendments. We haven't had any for a few years, but what you see on the ballot is simply a question, not all the text. Sample copies of that pink ballot are available at the Secretary of State's office and the County Auditor's office before the general election by law, and I suspect that for the most part they'd also be available on the Internet just by practice. On optical scan voting systems, the title of each amendment and the question that's specified by the legislature goes in the same booklet with the candidates. It goes after the state candidates and before the county candidates for people who live in optical scan areas. In an act that proposes a constitutional amendment, the legislature can designate the order in which questions will appear on the ballot. Some years when there are several amendments pending, the legislature sometimes cares about which one appears first. If the legislature doesn't specify an order, the Secretary of State is left to make that decision. During the 1990s, the Secretary of State put the questions on the ballot in the order that they passed the legislature. That's not by law. That was just their practice in the 90s. There hasn't been an amendment on the ballot since 1998, so I don't know what the practice would be now. But again, the legislature is free to specify that within a constitutional amendment if it has a strong feeling that it wants a certain question to be first or maybe for some reason last on the ballot. Since 1900, the Constitution has provided that the approval of a majority of those voting at the election is required in order to ratify an amendment. In other words, not a majority of those voting on the question. This means that failing to vote on an amendment is the equivalent of voting no on it. So the pink ballot carries a notice that tells people this, that, you know, declining to vote, failing to vote is the equivalent of a no vote. In practice, this extraordinary majority that Minnesota has means that it takes about a 60% approval rate at the polls to ratify an amendment. If the state canvassing board finds that number, whatever it is, that equals a majority of those voting at the election has been met, it will notify the governor, and the governor then proclaims the amendment to be ratified. An amendment takes effect when this action has occurred, when the canvassing board has said that it's been approved by the voters. If the legislature for any reason wanted a delayed date, and occasionally in the past it has wanted a delayed date on an amendment, it has to put that date in the question. For example, should Minnesota have initiative and referendum starting in 2012, or should we have a unicameral starting in 2012? If that's not in the question that went to the voters, courts in other states have held that delay won't be effective, and it will take effect as soon as the amendment would take effect as soon as the voters ratify it. So that's an important thing to know on those rare occasions when the legislature wants a delay. To the extent that we have time now, I'm going to tell you a few what I call sort of fun facts about constitutional amendments in Minnesota. Our state constitution was first amended before Minnesota was a state. While the state was a territory, every state in those days had to, of course, draft a constitution so that they would be ready to operate as a state when Congress admitted them to the Union. While that was happening, while the legislation was pending before Congress, the state decided to pass two constitutional amendments, one of them floating loans for railroad bonds, and the other one organizing state government. there was a book written in about 1921 by a political science professor who said that, as you might expect, the legality of those early amendments could be in question because there really wasn't a state yet, and they certainly weren't presented as a state general election because there hadn't been one yet. But over the years, the courts just kind of retroactively validated those amendments. Excluding repeat questions, over the course of statehood, there have been 177 different amendments sent to the voters. 118 of those have been ratified. The legislature has passed constitutional amendments at 68% of its regular sessions that have been held during the time of statehood, and it's also passed amendments at 6 special elections. The longest period of time without a question coming out of the legislature has been, we are actually in that time period now. 1998 is the last time that questions were on the ballot, so no session since then has the legislature passed an amendment. Amendments have been offered pretty steadily throughout the time of statehood, with the exception of the 1910s. In that decade, there was the largest number of amendments ever on the ballot. There were 29, and it had the lowest ratification rate, only 20%. So that there may have been a correlation or it may have been a coincidence, obviously, we can't establish that. The study that I did on constitutional amendments was trying to look at factors other than the substance of a question that might affect ratification rates. Because from time to time, members are wondering whether it's a problem if there are too many questions on the ballot, or does it help if there are a couple questions because it kind of, you know, stirs public interest. Does it matter? Is it more or less helpful to be on the ballot in a presidential election year? So anyway, there were a few factors that we tried to look at to see if they made a difference. And we did find that there were some factors that seemed to make a difference, bearing in mind that, of course, the most important thing is whether the people support the idea. The number of questions on the ballot seems to make a difference. How many times a question gets returned to the people if it fails the first time seems to make a difference. Presidential versus non-presidential year does make a difference. And the most important factor, of course, is the extraordinary majority vote that's required. It seems, looking first at the number of questions on the ballot, that the ideal number, if you want to get your idea passed, is 2 to 4 questions. When there are 2 to 4 questions, there seems to be a relatively higher rate of ratification than if there's only one or if there's more than 4. So there seems to be some kind of synergy involved, maybe in getting public interest. Obviously, we can't figure out what the reasons are, but it is noticeably, there's a higher ratification rate with 2 to 4 questions on the ballot. If a question fails the first time, the second time it comes back, it's not so successful. But a few questions have persevered for 3 or 4 times, and they have a higher ratification. When a question appears on the ballot only once, there's a 65% passage rate or ratification rate. For those that have come back 3 or 4 times, it goes up to 75. So if an idea that the legislature favors fails the first time, the second time may be, I guess, marking time. But those that have persisted for 3 or 4 times have had quite a bit of success. Then, as to the question between presidential and non-presidential years, the non-presidential year is a slightly better time to over the history of the state, and again, putting aside what the amendment is. In non-presidential years, there's been a 58% ratification rate. In presidential years, it's a 54% ratification rate. I have no idea. I don't think anybody can establish the reasons. Some people feel that when there's a larger turnout in presidential years, that may mean that the people who turn out are only interested in the president and they're not paying attention to constitutional amendments, so they don't vote on them, and then therefore they count as no's. But we can't, you know, as I said, we can't determine that reason. The biggest impact, very strong impact, on the ratification rates for amendments came when the extraordinary majority requirement was adopted. It was passed at the 1898 election and took effect in 1900. So in the 19th century, 72% of proposed amendments were ratified. Since that time, 49% have been ratified. So a big drop-off because of the fact that people who don't vote are counted as no's. During the 20th century, only 15% of the failed amendments had more no than yes votes. For the most part, the amendments that fail because they don't get enough yes votes. this idea, the majority, the supermajority, was the brainchild of the brewing industries. They were concerned about prohibition, and they were afraid that it would be put into the state constitution if a simple majority could amend the constitution. So they got this change adopted in 1898. Naturally, it was adopted by a minority of those voting at the election. Only 41% of all the voters voted, but they did vote by 68% to approve this change. Over the years, some academics have criticized the supermajority and said it makes it really hard for the Constitution to be flexible in the modern era. In 1974, the legislature tried to reduce this required margin. They proposed an amendment. The Constitution would say either a majority voting at the election or 55% of those voting on the question. So almost 59% of those who voted on the question said yes, that was a good idea, but it was defeated because there was a lot of fallout. There were a lot of people who didn't vote. And since 74, which is now over 30 years ago, the legislature has not brought back this sort of idea. They've just left the supermajority in the Constitution. In closing, I will just mention that although in some ways you may think that Minnesota is one of the tougher states for passing a constitutional amendment, every state does things to make it hard to amend their constitution, and it's sort of a question of where they put the barriers. Many of you may know that in some states, amendments have to pass the legislature twice in two successive sessions. Some states require an extraordinary majority in the legislature, 3/5 or 2/3 of the legislature. Some of them have combinations in which it has to pass the legislature twice, one time by a supermajority, once by a simple majority, and then maybe again in front of the voters by a supermajority. So, in fact, every state has a variety, not every state because there are actually groups, but there are a variety of ways that states try to make it tough, and Minnesota has chosen to make it fairly easy to get through the legislature by a simple majority and only one time, but then harder when it goes to the polls. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. McKnight, and I know that you have a blue booklet available through
yes.
House Research.
Yes, we have one of these publications. It's online, or if you'd like a copy of it, you know, give me a call, and I'd be happy to send you a hard copy.
Any questions from members? Thank you, Ms. McKnight. Okay, before we adjourn here, I just want to make note to the committee members, please save your information on Representative Demmer's bill, House File 973. We'll be hearing that bill tomorrow. And in addition to Representative Demmer's bill and Representative Seifert's bill, which is on your agenda, the third one that we'll hear tomorrow, I think it's on the website, Representative Bruce Anderson's bill, House File 171. So with that, members, meeting is adjourned.